I feel like I should put something of a consumer's warning on today's story. Neil Sims is selling fish, and he's very good at it.
It's incredibly rich, buttery flavor.
What Neil is selling is a new kind of ocean-farmed fish. He calls it the Kona Kampachi.
It's not dissimilar to hamachi, the Japanese yellowtail that most of your listeners are probably familiar with. If you've eaten any sushi, you've eaten hamachi, a Japanese yellowtail. It's a cleaner bite.
Neil claims that a new way of raising these fish, deep underwater, in cages suspended in ocean currents, may finally answer much of the environmental criticism about fish farming, and that it may point the way towards a kind of ocean ranching of fish that will give us a reliable and sustainable supply. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
About a month ago, the West Coast fishery for salmon was shut down, closed. In many places, that means no commercial fishing and no sports fishing. The first time in 160 years of regulation that such a lock has been imposed. It is an attempt to give West Coast salmon a chance to rebuild. You may remember the same thing happened to East Coast cod about 20 years ago. What were once considered to be the most abundant fish in the ocean are simply being fished out. That's why people like Neil Sims are looking for new ways, sustainable ways, to raise fish. A few years ago, he went diving inside a new kind of submerged fish farm. Let me try to describe its shape. Imagine you're holding two ice cream cones, one in each fist. Turn one upside down, place it on top of the other cone, and that's the shape of this underwater cage or net for raising fish off the coast of Hawaii.
I still remember Randy Cates, the contractor who'd been running this cage at the time. He opened up the zipper and I swam inside this. It was like an underwater cathedral and it was just breathtaking.
How big
and
is it?
They're 80 feet in diameter. So it's nothing like the shark cage that you imagine. This is huge. And the sense of spaciousness when you're in something like that underwater is phenomenal. It's amazing.
What did it look like from the inside?
There were two cones, the bases of the cones attached to one another. So it looks a little bit like a Chinese lantern. There's a central steel spar that runs up and down through the cage, and then there's a steel rim that runs around the equatorial belly of the cage that holds the net out taut. And then there are these two cones of netting. And the netting is Dyneema, which is a Kevlar-like material. So it's incredibly tough. It's very, very smooth to the touch. But it's a very robust architecture. It is similar, I think, to how cattle ranchers must have felt the first time they put a fence up and they realized they didn't have to go and chase their cows all over the range, that they could call this space their own. I came back that night to Kona and got on the phone to my co-founder, Dr. Dale Sava, and I said, Dale, I've seen the future of aquaculture. We've got to be part of this.
Neil Sims and his partner did get into this in a big way. They now run one of the new aquaculture companies in the U.S. called Kona Blue. Their fish, new to most of us, they call it the Kona Kampachi. Neil Sims has been in the fisheries business for the past 25 years. It all began with a two-year stint in the Australian version of the Peace Corps. Neil was sent to a remote part of the Pacific Cook Islands. Well, he liked it, and he came up with a way to extend his stay.
They just set up a new Ministry of Marine Resources, the government fisheries office, and I walked into their fisheries office and said, look, I speak the local language, and I've got fisheries biology training, and I'll work for food. Well, food and scuba tank air fills. And they said, great, you can be the fisheries research department. We don't really know what you should do, but go away and write yourself a job description and then go and do whatever you think you should be doing.
Well, Neil Sims already knew. In the time he'd spent diving around the Cook Islands, he'd seen the beginning of the end for some of the most vulnerable and most valuable underwater stocks.
They need to have some more rational basis for managing the commercial fisheries for pearl shell, for giant clam, and for trochus, which is a large snail that grows on the reef and also has a pearlescent nacreous shell. And it was just a great chance for people to go out and make some really significant money in a very short period of time. Or diving the pearl shell up in the northern atoll lagoons. People up there could make $300 a day, the best pearl shell divers. And so it was phenomenal money that could be made. But the resource had been really hammered, and all of the pearl shell through the shallow waters had been cleaned out. The divers were diving 90, 100, 120 feet to get to where there were still stocks of pearl oysters. And they all said that there were still a lot more pearl oysters down deeper. And so one of the first things I did was to go and do a survey of the lagoon and figure out what was the abundance and how were they distributed. And the curious thing was that below 20 fathoms, below 120 feet, there are almost no pearl oysters at all. And so this mythical reserve, natural reserve of pearl oysters below 20 fathoms did not exist.
As fisheries manager, Neil Sims saw the cycle repeating itself. As soon as something became commercially valuable, it was overfished until it was gone. Neil remembers when it happened with the trocha snail.
They taste like sort of snaily leather. They're really tough to eat, but can very easily go and pick them up and put them in a bag. And the pearly luster part of the shell, you can polish the shell up and you can get that pearly luster. And they were sold for buttons. And what I'd found there was it didn't matter what we did. You had set up size limits for the minimum size of snails that people could take, and we'd set a reserve area aside there where people couldn't go and fish inside the reserve area, and we'd have an island-wide quota, and then we actually changed that to try and have individual quotas for each person there. All of these various management measures that we tried to implement there, it didn't really matter. When you opened the lagoon and let people go, it was just mayhem out there. So
was it that the Cook Islanders themselves weren't really respecting this series of regulations that you were putting in because they'd been allowed to harvest the trocha snails for generations, and they're thinking, what is this guy from Australia doing showing up telling us that we can only, you know, go after them for 2 days in the season?
No, I don't think that it was something that Cook Island is, there was none of that sense about it. What I found was that it's typical of people throughout the planet. It's just this tragedy of the commons that Garrett Hardin wrote about in 1955, when you've got a common property resource, which most of the marine resources were held in common property, that there's a tremendous incentive for people to go out and get more than their fair share.
Give me an example, if you can, Neil, of a person or a fisherman that you would have come to some sort of disagreement with over this when you're trying to manage the resource, though.
I'd gone through a couple of iterations of this. We were trying to have an annual harvest. After another harvest season where they'd exceeded the island quota by a factor of three or so, and there'd been undersized snails being collected and people had been collecting inside the reserve area, I was really dejected. And it was towards sunset, a couple of evenings after we'd closed the lagoon to fishing, and I'm walking along the edge of the lagoon really dejected, and I came across this old man with his canoe pulled up on the beach, and he's sitting there with a bag of trocha snails, still live, fresh trocha snails. He'd obviously collected them that day in his canoe. And part of the challenge that I had there is not only was I in charge of the research, but then also I was trying to develop the management mechanisms there. And also, because I was the only one that wasn't related to everybody else in the village, I was often in charge of the enforcement. And so I had to go and, Papa, what are you doing? You know the lagoon's been closed for the last 2 days. You've been out there collecting more trochas. I'm going to have to confiscate your trochas. And this old man, he might have been 80 years old. He had about three teeth left in his mouth. And he starts crying and he speaking to me in my mouth, saying, that's my Christmas money. That's my, oh, you can't take those now. They're my, because this was his only source of cash. And it was October or November or so, and this was going to be his money for Christmas. And I said, but you knew the lagoon was closed. You knew we couldn't go and keep fishing it. And he said, well, why did you stop it? Why did you stop it? There's still some left. There's still some left out there. I can see them. And to me, that was just, I threw up my hands in frustration. And I don't know actually if it was exactly at that time or whether it's just in hindsight. I look back at that as being a real epiphany for me of just, if we couldn't get the message of sustainable resource management through to this 80-year-old Polynesian who must have seen endless cycles of pillage and plunder and then resources being hammered down to near extinction and then years for them to reestablish themselves. He'd seen this, I'm sure, time and time again throughout his life. If we couldn't get him to understand that we need to have management of these wild stock resources, then really what hope was there? We needed to move towards something that was more proactive, more assertive, more truly sustainable. And that was aquaculture.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Neil Sims began to think about it then. Some of these shellfish could be raised in hatcheries, grown in a way that could feed or supply people more steadily without the dramatic cycles of boom and bust. One local pearl diver decided to try it. John Metty had sent his son to Tahiti to learn how to farm oysters.
John Metty took me out onto the pearl farm. At that stage, it was just a submerged platform, a raft on legs, as it was, where he had these strings of pearl oysters hanging from this raft there. And to me, it was beautiful, because throughout the rest of the lagoon, you had to work really hard to find an oyster within freediving depth. But here on this platform, he had 30 or 40,000 beautiful pearl oysters there. Once you start to move away from a wild stock fishery towards farming, you can re-establish the wild stocks, and you can also create stable sources of income for people. But it's a beautiful place to work, and it's really exciting. And I think both of those were at work there when he was thinking about this and the potential for pearl farming.
And did it work out for him?
In the long run, yes, but it's never easy. It's never a straight line. And I sometimes like to think about back 10,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent. You can imagine the furor that was met with the first poor fool who dragged a cow into the middle of the village and said, guys, maybe we should farm them, you know, keep them here in the middle of the village, and then we can have milk and meat whenever we want. And he would have been just lambasted. He would have been ridiculed, because people would have said, well, what are we going to feed them? And, well, think of the stench and the noise, and it's going to be unsightly, and we can't do this. And luckily, he persisted enough, and this has got us to where we are today.
The experiment with the pearl oysters began something of a turnaround in the Cook Islands. By the time Neil Sims left, he'd seen that part of the economy transformed from fishing to farming. And before long, Neil began to wonder if it worked so well for the pearls, could it also work for the fish? And I'll talk with him more about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Fish farming has a bad name, particularly with carnivorous fish like salmon. They are raised in wide surface nets in ocean inlets. Because they can't swim the way they're meant to, their flesh is softer and they're prone to disease. But scientists and business people like Neil Sims are looking for better ways to farm fish, saying there really is no alternative, that the trawling and the dragging and the netting of wild stocks has become so efficient that no one species being targeted can survive. Kona Kampachi is one of the latest offerings you may see in the store. It's not caught in the open ocean, but it is raised there in large underwater cages. Neil Sims is one of the business people behind this venture.
Kona Kampachi is a tropical yellowtail. In the wild, in Hawaii, it's considered a trash fish because it has a history of ciguatera. That's a reef toxin that accumulates up through the food chain and gets to the top-end predators, such as the yellowtails. But by farming the fish, by growing them all the way from hatch through to harvest, we're able to avoid the ciguatera. And also, the farmed fish quality is tremendously a tremendous improvement over wild fish. In the wild, the fish have about 3 to 4% fat. But when we farm them, we can get up over 30% fat in the Kona Kampachi. And remember, Dick, this is all the good fat. This is the fish oils. These fish are loaded with omega-3 fatty acids, the heart-healthy omega-3s that are so important. For people are realizing increasingly how important they are for good nutrition. And also, because we control the diet all the way from hatch through to harvest, we have no detectable mercury. It's a beautiful fish to grow. They reach about 4 pounds, 5 pounds harvest size in around a year. Other tremendous factor of Kona Kampachi is that it just tastes great. And I still remember one of the epiphanies. The direction, the arc of the company was back when we first figured out how to apply, we'd applied our invertebrate hatchery technology that we'd been using for pearl oysters and for giant clams. We'd been able to apply that to marine fish hatchery species. And so over the course of 3 years, we'd been able to culture perhaps 8 different species in the hatchery there. We'd cultured are some of the deep water snapper, the opakapaka, that are grown there, that are wild there in Hawaii. We'd cultured some peacock grouper, which is an incredibly tasting fish, but in the wild you can't eat it in Hawaii because, again, it has ciguatera. And we'd cultured a couple of different trevallies. And then also this Kona kampachi, which we knew it was related to hamachi, so we were curious about this. And as we'd grow each of these fish through in the hatchery, my co-founder, Dale Sava, who I'd mentioned earlier, he has the more discerning palate of the two of us. Dale's a real foodie, and I'm an Aussie, and Aussies figure that all seafood tastes great. So as we'd grow these fish through to a 3/4 of a pound size or so, it was Dale's job to take them home and taste them and evaluate them and come back and, yeah, this one tastes pretty good, or this one's actually not bad. And then he got to take home one of the Kona kampachi one night, and he came back the next morning just breathless and waving his arms and hyperventilating and his eyes wide. He's like, Neil, this fish is fantastic. And I'm like, that's great, Dale, that's great. Come on, we got to go and change the water in these tanks. He's like, no, you don't understand it, Neil. This fish is just phenomenal. We're going to build the company on this species. And I'm like, what do you mean? He says, it's an amazing fish. This is the best fish I've ever tasted. And we went and took another fish out of the tank and we had some more of it. And both as a cooked product, because it's got so much of that, the rich oils in there, the fish oils in there, it's incredibly rich flavor. It doesn't have a strong fishy flavor in there. And so it also makes tremendous sashimi because it has that really high 30% fish oil content in there. And I think most people who've eaten Kona kampachi, they can remember the very first time that they tasted it. We didn't choose this fish. This fish found us.
Do you, Neil, remember the first time you tasted it?
Absolutely, yes.
How was it cooked?
It was raw. It was it's incredibly rich, buttery flavor. It's a very clean bite. It's not dissimilar to hamachi, the Japanese yellowtail that most of your listeners are probably familiar with. If you've eaten any sushi, you've eaten a tuna and hamachi, a Japanese yellowtail. It's not dissimilar to hamachi, but it's a cleaner bite. You don't have any of the residual feeling of the tacky palate.
Mm-hmm.
And when it cooks up, it's a really light, rich flavor.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. So far, the people who help us decide what is good for us and what's good for the planet say the underwater farming of this fish is working out pretty well. The Monterey Bay Aquarium has devised 3 seafood watch categories: best choice, good alternative, and avoid. Now, the aquarium doesn't use the trademark name Kona kampachi. They talk about the American farmed yellowtail. But Neil's fish just got itself a good alternative listing. Neil says it's one way to get past this image of the farmed fish swimming around in its own excrement.
When people first started farming salmon, and their understanding of this was back in the early 80s, their understanding of the way marine ecosystems worked was very limited. Their engineering was really limited, so that they'd naturally put their cages. Their cages were often just hammered together bits of 2x4 boards, or 4x6s. They were a little bit more robust than that, but they'd put them in the most protected fjords and protected bays that they could. Over time, they realized that if you mistreat Mother Nature, she'll come back and bite you in the buttock fairly soon and fairly hard. And so salmon farming has, in the last 20, 25 years, just made tremendous leaps forward in terms of its sustainability, moving into more exposed sites. And there are a number of salmon farms in Scotland and Ireland that are pretty much what you would call open ocean fish farms. They still use the surface cages because it's brutally cold water. But they've improved the engineering to where they can go out into farm sites that essentially face the full brunt of the North Sea. And so this is, I think, where the key is. It's not so much in the submersible cages. It's just moving into deeper water and moving further away from shore. Deeper water with stronger currents as well. Yeah. You have less impact on the ocean floor beneath you. And then there's less potential for a feedback loop. For if you have an impact on the substrate underneath you, then there's less chance of that affecting the fish in the cages. But also, as a fish farmer, I want to move out into cleaner water where there's less potential for runoff from land to have an effect on the water quality.
Tell me something, Neil. Do you go diving around the cages that you have now for the Kona Kampache? I mean, is there a lot of current down there? What's it like when you're that far down in those areas?
The technical term for these is actually rip snorting currents. They're a farm site there. It's really brisk, and sometimes it's challenging. I like to take people out onto the farm site, but we're really limited in being able to take people into the water because it's very challenging there. The currents can pick up, and they're unpredictable, and they can be very, very strong, stronger than you or I could swim against. And it really is blue water. Kona Blue Water Farms is blue in more than just name. We've got over 3 years' worth of data, I think, up there on our website now. You can't tell the difference in water quality between the water that's upcurrent of the cage and that which is downcurrent of the cage.
Those in the business of aquaculture are eager to change its image. You can hear it in Neil Sims' description of his own work. Neil was making a presentation recently, talking about a new kind of feed they were using, and he knew that Becky Goldberg, a woman with environmental defense, was listening in.
And so Becky came up to me after I'd given a presentation to a group at somewhere, and I'd been very proud of the fact that we're feeding organic feed, and she said, Neil, you really ought to look at the long-term sustainability and scalability of Peruvian anchovies. It really doesn't hold up under scrutiny. And you might want to think about what you're really feeding your fish. And we looked at this, and our feed was 80% Peruvian anchovies, which Peruvian anchovies are a very well-managed fishery. It's sustainable, but it's not really scalable. If we're going to grow aquaculture in the way that we need to, it's not because Peruvian anchovies are under any immediate danger of collapsing, but we need to scale aquaculture globally.
What was your reaction when she said that?
Oh, really? I want to find out more about that. And there had ensued a discussion there. We can't continue relying on wild fish stocks, that we have to move towards more sustainable sources of seafood supply, and that aquaculture, we have to learn how to do it right. It's not enough to stand on the sidelines and say, aquaculture won't work. And so you see really great steps forward, like the World Wildlife Fund has been engaging industry in these dialogues for sustainability certification processes for various salmon and trout and tilapia.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Neil Sims says it's been slow getting people to buy the kampache in grocery stores. He says the best way to get people interested is to offer the fish in restaurants.
Retail outlets, we find, if we support the introduction of Kona Kampache there by having demonstrations in the aisles or by having well-educated counter staff, then it flies off the shelves. But because it's a new fish, people are often reluctant in retail to embrace a new fish. They see a fish there in the counter that they've never heard of before. They're reluctant to embrace it. So really what we see as being where we are on the cutting edge of educating consumers is in white tablecloth restaurants, because there you have wait staff that are well educated about the issues of sustainability. And we actually have little wait staff cards that we like to have waiters carry around in their top pocket. And when somebody sees it on the printed menu, and we can actually be on the printed menu rather than being on the chalkboard, because we have regular supply. It's not a matter of whether the fishermen can find the fish and catch the fish or not. We know we harvest twice a week. And so there's this consistency of supply. And so we're on the printed menu and people see it and they go, oh, what's this Kona Kampache? And the waiter has 5 seconds right there to say, oh, that's sustainably open ocean raised in some of the purest waters on earth. And you ought to really try that. Or if he just goes and says, oh, that's farmed. If he says it, then he's lost them. It is, as you would, it's a different kettle of fish.
You raised a few eyebrows recently by starting to feed, I think, ground-up chicken to the Kona Kampache. What was behind that?
Oh, be careful, Dick, please. It's not ground-up chicken. But when they're processing poultry, they take the breasts and the legs, the thighs, and they put them in package. And there's a significant portion of the chicken that's left over. And so at the moment, this waste stream of proteins and oils, it's either going to cat food or dog food. But it's beautiful nutritional balance for fish food. We have to find alternative sources. And so that's why we are looking at, in the pollock fishery in Alaska, this is where most of your fake crab legs come from pollock. And it's just, they'll take the fillet off the pollock. Two-thirds of that fish is head and bones and guts and trimmings. And at the moment, a lot of that is thrown over the back of the boat. What we'd really like to see is fishery regulations changed so that the fishermen are given an incentive to bring back the pollock meal and pollock oil, to bring that back to us, because that's an incredible resource that we can then use in converting it into great-tasting sashimi. And so there are numerous ways that we can move towards a more sustainable aquaculture industry. We just have to change the way that we view things and the way that we operate and the relationship that we have with the ocean.
Neil Sims readily admits that his company's offshore farming of the Kona Kampachi is a business that has to grow larger if it's going to make any kind of difference in supplying sustainable fish.
We are growing a fresh sashimi product in the most isolated archipelago on the planet. And so a logical next step for Kona Blue is to move towards an area where we can just truck our fish into the US market. Once we can reduce the price a little bit more here by moving to an area where we can truck our fish in rather than fly it in, then all of a sudden we can start to be in the more broad scale restaurants, in more of the broader retailers, rather than at the moment where we're in the very high end white tablecloth and the high end specialty retailers. And for me, that's where we're really going to start to have an impact.
You're in D.C. right now, I know, talking with regulators about, you know, how to define sustainability and stuff like that. Do you bring a freezer load of Kona Kampachi with you when you go to these meetings?
I like to say that there's nothing that oils the wheels of a discussion more than Kona Kampachi. Last week I was at a meeting here where the North America industry and regulators were coming together to discuss a single, more unified structure for certifying sustainability. I should have brought some, you're right. I can steer people towards where they can find it.
When do you think you'll know that you've achieved something? Because there's really, as I see it, there's two things at play here. One is the success of your own company and finding a fish that is both popular and marketable and you can do well. But the other is, in a way, trying to find a better definition of what is sustainable fish farming. And I mean, they may not be inclusive or exclusive, but when are you going to know that you found the formula that you're looking for?
I like to think we've already made significant strides, huge strides. The organic industry likes to talk about how down on the individual farm level that there is this goal of continuous improvement. You're never done. There's always going to be challenges of how to do things in a more sustainable way. One of the issues I'm going to be talking about here is how I think that there really is a great opportunity for open ocean aquaculture and marine protected areas. There's a great synergy there. Here in Washington, there's a lot of discussion about how you should exclude aquaculture from national marine sanctuaries, which strikes me as very curious, because most national marine sanctuaries, you still do allow commercial fishing. So what is it? What's the mindset here where people are trying to exclude aquaculture? And again, it's just, to me, it is just this block that people have about fish farming. But if you look at it, an appropriately sited open ocean aquaculture farm, then you actually increase the productivity and you increase the biodiversity, because it provides a structure that attracts fish around it, because most of the open ocean is vast blue desert. And you still have employment opportunities for commercial fishermen who can go and turn their swords into plowshares.
I think it's fish hooks into plowshares, isn't it?
There you go.
Neil Sims is president of the company Kona Blue. If you check our website at thestory.org, you can read more about the fish he's marketing, the Kona Kampachi, and you can also look at those seafood guides that we've been talking about. A couple of days ago, I spoke with Melissa Hilliard. You might remember she had recently made her first trip to the food bank, even though she has a full-time job and her husband's working as well. While Melissa feels she is working as hard as she can, but the lack of a college degree is holding her back and hurting her family, and she's not sure how she can make it.
And now I get up and I bathe my kids and I dress them and I go to work and I come home and I go to bed. And I don't know where I'm going to get the energy to go to school, but I know if I don't, that there's really no hope.
After Melissa was on the story, I got a number of letters, including these words of encouragement from Bobby in Duluth, Minnesota. Bobby wrote, "I would like to tell Melissa Hilliard some reassuring things. I grew up quite poor and also had very few friends. I mostly sat in my room and read or swung on our pecan tree outside. I had no idea we were poor. I thought my mom just wasn't a very good cook. One of my boyfriends was quite wealthy, but for some reason I never felt embarrassed when he came to our shabby house to pick me up. At age 30, I went to college and graduated with 2 degrees, summa cum laude. So you, Melissa, are doing everything right for your family with all your love and closeness. And your kids are going to do very well." If you have any thoughts on stories that you're hearing on the program, letters that you'd like to write, or stories you'd like to tell me about, go to our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. One thing I've discovered here is that stories live in places where we sometimes don't expect to find them. You know, in lost objects that are recovered, or in poems and photographs, and also in recipes. A couple of years ago, I talked with Amy Cyrex, and she had lost all her treasured recipes in Hurricane Katrina.
I had shelves of cookbooks after cookbook after cookbook, and then I had binders of handwritten recipes that people had given me, whether it was family or friends, or we went to a party and I asked the hostess for a copy of whatever recipe she had that she had served. So all of these things were all on the shelves, and actually part of the shelves had fallen out of the wall, and we had, you know, anywhere between 6 inches to a foot of mud throughout the whole house. So some of that stuff was completely covered in this black, gooey, nasty mud. And so the handwritten recipes that I had, you couldn't even read because the paper got so wet, it just kind of turned into a clump on the floor. But my cookbooks that stayed on the shelf got this kind of grayish film over them, so you could still read the titles, but you knew that there's no way you could unstick the pages together to try and salvage it. And one of the disappointments is, you know, I could go back and buy those cookbooks again, but I write notes in the margins. This is good. Add a little salt, add extra onions, or this is a really terrible recipe, whichever one. So I know to refer to it the next time I cook it. And all those notes were gone.
That tragedy ended up being something of a bonus in Amy's kitchen because people then gathered to share new recipes. Well, Amy collected those, put them in a self-published book. It was an exercise that brought her closer to her own family.
The hot oyster dip in the book is something that my mother-in-law gave me. And when she gave it to me, knowing that I was working on the book, she kind of joked because she said, "Well, the guy that gave this to me said it's a secret recipe, so don't give it to anybody." But I made a note in the book that you shouldn't give it to anybody. It's a secret recipe. But
so what's in it? What's it taste like?
Ooh, it's good. It's creamy. It's got lots of cheese and onions and breadcrumbs. And it's great to dip little toast points in. Or, heck, you could probably just eat it with a spoon.
A few days ago, I got another note about mothers-in-law and recipes. This one came from Allison Vogt. She wrote to say that in February 2007, my mother-in-law moved in with us. She was an avid cook, and we had such great times planning our meals together. So I'm reading this, and I'm interested in knowing how two women, a mother and daughter-in-law, so easily share a kitchen. I asked Allison about the first time she met Ruth, her future mother-in-law.
I'm not actually sure that I remember the first day I met her, but I remember one time really early in our relationship when she had a party at her house, and she was always entertaining and always had fabulous food.
Now, you were a teenager at this point or a little more grown up than
that? I was probably in my early 20s at that time. And, you know, I'm from New York, and when you think about, you know, kind of traditional Southern cooking, we always think about the overcooked fatback, but I think of my mother-in-law as an urban Southern cook, where things were always beautifully presented and really healthy. And always, you know, even though she cooked for a crowd, it was never that kind of crowd cooking, you know, where you just tried to make as much of something as you could. It was always really good stuff.
Where was she raised, Allison?
She was born in Raleigh, which is, you know, really almost unheard of at this point.
So the first time you met her, how did she react to you?
Well, the first time I met her, I remember leaving her house and she hugged me and she told me that she loved me, which was so strange because I don't easily say that. And as I came to know her, she didn't easily say that either.
Oh, it wasn't her usual farewell for anyone who came to her house.
I don't think so. You know, when, as I got to know her, I realized one of the things that I really admired the most about her is how she chose her words. She always said what she meant.
Do you suspect that she warmed to you early on because she saw something in you? Did you guys have some kind of connection?
I'm not really sure. I remember, and I've always told my husband that the reason I married him was because I fell in love with his mother, and he's
okay
much like
that.
Her. He is.
Yeah.
He is. Yeah, I guess it works for him. But when I told him about, you know, coming here today, he wanted to be sure that I mentioned that she had said when he was a boy that if he learned how to make an omelet, that he would never go hungry. Those were her words of wisdom to him. And I remember early in our relationship, some of the omelets that he made for me. And I wondered, that wasn't part of what attracted me toward him, was his own cooking and how she was able to provide for him through that wisdom. And I guess food can often be a metaphor for the love that mothers have for their children, and, you know, and then how you can go and spread that, you know, those recipes or those ways of fixing things.
Well, food wound up being something of a common ground for you and Ruth, your mother-in-law.
Absolutely,
right?
It really was.
Was it a competition?
No, it never was a competition. There was never anything competitive about her. She gladly shared, you know, and it got to be a joke really between the two of us because I'd fix something that was probably pretty good. And she'd say it was the best thing she'd ever had, you know. And every night we were eating the best thing she'd ever had. It was really kind of funny. We'd laugh about it. So what was last night if tonight's the best meal you've ever had? You know?
But if you're the daughter-in-law, the new daughter-in-law, the daughter-in-law-to-be, I can see you being a little bit nervous having to prepare something for your mother-in-law. Was it hard to cook for her early on in your relationship?
I don't remember that. I've always really been passionate about cooking myself. And so it was more an opportunity to
flex a little bit.
Well, yeah.
Do something interesting.
Yeah.
Sounds like respect of equals between
mutual,
the two of
yeah,
you. Fair
yeah.
enough.
I remember we have always have Christmas at my house, and I don't know why you would try to make risotto for 30 people. Have you ever had risotto? Have you ever tried to make it? It's like something that's a challenge if you're just going to feed 8 people. But I decided that I would make it for 30 people. And I don't like to use recipes when I cook because I like to read and I like to cook, but I don't think you should try to do them both at the same time. So I always need a reader, especially when I'm going to cook for a crowd. And she sat down in the chair in the kitchen with her oxygen, you know, and the recipe. And she'd say, Allison, that needs more broth. And I'd say, no, it doesn't need more broth. And she'd get up and, you know, she was less than 4 feet tall and she weighed 84 pounds. And she'd pick herself up and look over that big pot on the stove and she'd, oh, you're right. It doesn't need any more broth. And she did that a couple of times. It was really funny.
You spent a lot of time in the kitchen together then.
Yes, we really did. And after she moved in with us, she really had a desperate need to be useful. I think that that's really common with older people. She didn't want to be a burden. And I'm not sure I ever was very good at convincing her that she wasn't a burden. I mean, the blessings that she added to our lives far outnumbered what we gave to her. But every night she would want to help chop something or, you know, and she would sit there at the chair at her kitchen table and she'd have her little cutting board and she would cut things all up, you know, just perfectly. And she really enjoyed being helpful. And one of the things that happened, I guess it was probably back in the fall, I knew I had chicken in the refrigerator and I was coming home and I thought, you know, I can't believe I've never made really true Southern fried chicken. And so I came home and I said, Ruth, we're going to fry some chicken tonight, you know, and she goes over and she gets this cookbook that she had and she just starts to laugh. She had this wonderful laugh. And I'm like, what's so funny? And she said that the author of the cookbook said that if you couldn't find a fresh chicken, that you should just, because frozen chicken just doesn't taste right, you should just stew it or bury it. And then she went on to tell this wonderful story about when she was a little girl in Raleigh. The chicken man, I guess, what would you call him, the poultry man, would come down the street with his wagon of live chickens, and her mother would go out there and pick one, And she'd wring its neck and throw it in the backyard and go in and boil a pot of water. And I thought, what must it be like to have your life had spanned so much, you know, to go from there to now we go buy frozen chicken at the grocery store, you know.
So would Ruth then have approved of frozen chicken as a source of Southern fried chicken?
Yeah.
Did you get away with it that
night?
Do you
remember? Did. We had no choice because we're not keeping chickens in the backyard.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Allison Vogt's mother-in-law moved in with the family after she'd had a fall. Now, the incident was something of a wake-up call for the family, a sign that Ruth perhaps should no longer be living on her own. Fortunately, Allison's family had the perfect room for Ruth to move right in.
It was really interesting to see the transformation that room had been used. We called it an office, but it really was just the room where the computer is, which is a ridiculous reason for a room, you know. So it quickly became her bedroom. And to watch it transform from a really unattractive room to a beautiful room with her things in there. And she just had a way about her, a style, you know, that she brought her few things out there. And it was a perfect place for her.
Did you have any second thoughts about having her move in with you?
Absolutely not. The greatest gift really was the ease at which she accepted our invitation. It's hard when you have aging parents and it gets to be the point where you know that they are not safe anymore. And what a burden that puts on the people who love you, you know, to worry about them.
And, well, and a burden on her, too, to acknowledge that kind of dependency. I know that,
right.
You know, I'm kind of at the same stage right now. My mother's very healthy, but there will come a time when, you know, she may not be. And right. I know that she really values her independence, right, and would never – I can't imagine her reaching the point where she would say, yeah, I can't do this on my own
right.
anymore. Was that hard for her to reach that stage?
It didn't seem like it was, although it must have been. She was living completely independently. Up until the time she moved out, she was driving herself places. But I think she recognized her fall, I think, was really scary to her as well.
What did other people say, Allison? Were there friends of yours who raised an eyebrow and went, oh.
Well, people always did, you know, and I would say, my mother-in-law's moved in. And, you know, that's kind of a great relationship to joke about, you know, isn't it?
Well,
and,
it's a classic punchline for a joke, isn't it?
It's a classic one, yeah. And I, you know, it was funny because I would have to spend a moment or two convincing people that it wasn't a problem. It wasn't a problem at all.
And they're going, oh, you're just being polite.
Right.
You know, your husband is insisting, and what choice do you have?
Right, right. Well, people who know me really well would never think that because, yeah.
The interesting thing is that it is a little bit, it's not unusual, but it's notable here in North America, but it's the sort of thing that would be done almost as a matter of course in much of the world.
Absolutely. And I thought that so many times too, you know, that here we still have a very busy household. I have three daughters and we always have people at my house, it seems like, and sometimes we're loud and the kids are loud. And she would go to bed and I would say to her the next morning, I hope we didn't keep you up last night. And she would always say, it was the sweetest thing, she'd always say, I just loved hearing you all having a good time and listening to the laughter. You know, we think a lot of people would have said, yeah, you kept me up and I didn't sleep. But it's just the kind of person that she was. She loved having people around her. And even in the middle of the night, which must have been to her, she didn't mind hearing the voices. And
how about the early days, the adjustments? I mean, were there times when you were lying in bed thinking, well, I better get downstairs just in case Ruth is up, or I want to get to the kitchen before she does to get the coffee started, or she doesn't know where the orange juice is? I mean, all that, mm-hmm. you know, kind of jockeying for space, because let's face it, sharing a kitchen is not something a lot of people do easily, either from your perspective or from your mother-in-law's perspective.
Really, I don't remember any competition or butting of heads, but it was like she felt like she needed to pay us back for being there, and she did that with her recipes. That was kind of one of the jobs I had given to her, to figure out what we should fix next week for dinner. You know, find the recipe, I'll go get the things, we'll fix it, and then she could have some control and some power, which we all want, and her dignity.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. When Allison Vogt sent me her letter, she mentioned that her mother-in-law, Ruth, stayed with the family for a year. Ruth passed on this past February. Allison says that just a few weeks ago, she was going through Ruth's things and came upon her recipe box. Allison brought the box here to the studio with her. It's that standard 4x6-inch beige index card file. This one's crammed with bits of paper and yellowing newspaper clippings.
I never looked through it because that would have kind of been an invasion of privacy. It was hers. But after she passed, it was just so interesting to look at the things that she loved. I've only gotten to see, I haven't actually looked all the way through it, but, you know, you start out with the avocados and the asparagus and the artichokes, and then you move on to the beans and the Bloody Marys and the broccoli. And she had three recipes for crab cakes, so I guess she must have really liked crab cakes.
When did you open the recipe box? When did you start looking through her recipes?
Just a few days ago, actually. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of, as I go through it, a lot of familiar things about it. But I had this real sense that I wanted to somehow memorialize it, because I'm sure there's some things in there that were her old favorites and some that she had never made, you know. And I just had this idea that it would be really cool to have a journal, you know, today we made this and it was good, or today we made that and it wasn't so good. I don't know. I just really, I can't quite decide how to, it just doesn't seem right not to do something with it.
What's under O there? Is omelets listed under there somewhere?
I don't know. Okra. Dilled okra.
There you go. That's a Raleigh Cook's specialty. That probably doesn't show up in the Michigan book.
No, probably not. And she probably never had a recipe for an omelet. It always was whatever you had in the house.
Right. Yeah. Who would write it down? It's in your head, right?
Right.
Has your husband taken a look through there? I mean, some of his history is probably in that
box
as well.
Probably it is.
What are you thinking you're going to do with it, Allison? Are you thinking you might sort of unpack it, spread it out, and see what it all looks like?
I think that I probably will. And I don't know. I just don't have a vision yet of what it will look like. I don't know.
Let me ask you something else. Did your mother-in-law, did Ruth leave you anything like this piece of furniture is for you or this or that or that? I'm not talking about, you know, the inheritance stuff that happens in the lawyer's office, but any treasure of hers that this is for you?
No, she really didn't do her things that way. You know, they've had this kind of come and pick your stuff.
Yeah.
A few of her pieces of jewelry, just some costume stuff that she, shortly after she moved out, she brought this big Tupperware thing of all of her costume jewelry and said to my daughters, just take whatever you want to. And then said that to their friends as well. And I'm like, we can't do this. So I kind of pulled back some things so that it wouldn't just all go.
The reason I'm asking you is it occurs to me that this common language of cooking that you shared with your mother-in-law and the fact that you have inherited her private little trove of recipes, that that's maybe
probably
the inheritance, whether she intended it or not.
Right.
That's your inheritance, right?
Probably so.
So you feel some kind of need to do something with it?
Yeah, I think so.
Have you cooked anything in there?
I did, as a matter of fact, the other night. Oh, it was cool.
What'd you cook?
It was like a stir-fry broccoli. What do you do with broccoli? We all need new ways to cook broccoli.
How did it turn out?
It was good.
Allison Vogt lives in Apex, North Carolina. She joined me here in our Chapel Hill studios. So what are the mementos that might have been left for you, or some object that maybe carries with it a story or some kind of family history that may be a little bit unexpected? If you'd like to talk about that, you can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org. You can call and leave me a message on our telephone at 1-888-966-9862. That's 1-888-966-9862. Or write me a letter, care of The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Zip code's 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
This story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.